Dave, welcome to Flanagan's Net Positive Podcast. I'm just delighted to have you here.
Thanks, Ted. It's great to be here with you as well.
Good. And you're tuning in from Carbondale, Colorado, up on Missouri Heights, if I'm is that right?
Yes, you don't want to see the view I'm looking at because you'll die with envy.
I know your view so well. It is absolutely gorgeous.
When I purchased this, I like to say that I had a $250,000 house with a $3 million view.
It's so exceptional up there. I've been up in Missouri Heights looking out into the mountains. Born and raised where, Dave?
East Bay, California. I was born in San Francisco and grew up just outside of Berkeley in those hills there, overlooking the bay.
What a great spot. And what did Dave Monk like to do when he was a little boy?
I like to get outdoors. Being in the mountain environment's always been a high priority for me and for my family growing up. And so our annual highlight vacation was 2 weeks in Yosemite, in the higher country there. So that was instilled with me early, and I went backpacking with my dad and spent a lot of time in various parts of the Sierras.
Nice. And then college off to UC Davis. I noticed when I was doing a little digging around, I'd forgotten that you had the word agriculture in your major.
Right. Well, basically, I went to a university to get a basic business degree, which an undergrad degree. So you can't just have a regular business degree at Davis. So at UC Davis, it's called agricultural economics slash business management.
Right. So you didn't envision yourself out on a farm at any point in your career.
Not so much.
Well, how did you get to Colorado? What was it that shifted you from the Bay Area or California to the mountains of Colorado?
Well, it's kind of an interesting story as I was reflecting on it, Ted, because right out of college, I worked for a fledgling solar energy company headed by David Springer. And it was one of the first in the country, as I understood it. But I wasn't really equipped or trained or knowledgeable enough to provide anything of value. I realized there was not enough there for me. And so I figured, well, I better really get out into the world and learn something. So I wasn't really enamored with the cities in California at the time, so I decided to take a road trip and ended up in Denver, and then kind of jumped into just the basic first job type experiences of management trainees and things like that.
So then at some point you migrated up into the mountains, up to the Roaring Fork Valley.
Yeah.
How long were you in Denver?
Well, I was in Denver for only a couple of years. I started in on a bank management program, and they fired me, which I later took to be a kind of a compliment. And then I kind of landed with Westinghouse Electric Supply Company. And so that's sort of like a hardware store for electric products. And I was in their management training program. I started in Denver, got transferred to Grand Junction, Colorado. I was there in 1982 when the oil shale crash happened, and that kind of gutted their business. So I actually got transferred from there to Casper, Wyoming, which was sufficiently dismal to get me to leave Westinghouse and return to Western Colorado. So then I spent the next few years in publishing sales.
And that was Grand Junction.
No, I came down to the valley here. I first lived in Carbondale and sort of ran the circuit. I moved from Carbondale to Aspen and then, slowly made my way back down valley to where I am in Carbondale again.
And was skiing a big part of your life then?
You know, it really wasn't. I was thinking back to when I first skied getting here. I started skiing when I was 11. I was obviously a little bit older when I got here in my, middle 20s, but I basically couldn't ski. And so I remember going out, and I moved here in one of the biggest snow years, in it's legendary in 1983, 84, was that winter. And then I started working for the ski company teaching skiing, and that's how I learned to ski. And so I, really took that on.
And you and I met in around, I think, around 1990. And I was heading up a company called IRT Environment. And you joined on as our business development person and helped me sort of see some of that. But that didn't last for very long. But then you moved on and started working for, I think, was it Ray Engel? And he had it was basically a showerhead manufacturer. And I remember having that early conversation with him. He was so interested in, and how do I move from being a showerhead manufacturer to sort of putting my showerheads in kits and getting them out to students in the tens of thousands? And that's when you joined him to sort of move into that space.
That's correct, Ted. I had the great experience of working for two fantastic entrepreneurs in Ray Engel and Christian Schader. And yeah, you have hit it right on the head. Manufacturer with a really unique and high performance, high efficiency showerhead, which was kind of a unique product combination at the time. And on top of that fantastic design, being sort of an entrepreneur and not having the horsepower of a Kohler or a Delta, they were thinking, well, how can we really make a move into the market? And what they did is came up with this concept of combining the hardware with education and then applying that to water and energy utilities for compliance with their then emerging conservation requirements and energy efficiency requirements.
Yeah. So how did that go? I mean, I recall you had, you know, big utilities here in California, like Southern California Edison as your clients. But talk about sort of how extensive that became, that whole effort.
Well, it really built out. It predominantly in the West, but it really tracked wherever there were water and increasingly more so on the energy side. The energy savings were more significant, and then that was more regulated by public utility commissions. And so these utilities were looking for ways to burnish both their efficiency reputations, but also get some PR benefit from it. So having a bunch of fifth and sixth graders out there becoming your ambassadors was an easy venue for utilities to sponsor this, knock off a few of their energy efficiency goals, but also get some great press in the meantime.
Right. So each student, I mean, you would enroll, I guess a utility would sponsor classroom activities in their territory. And then each student, I guess I had a little bit of a hand in designing the early box, but each student would get a little box that would have a shower head and a faucet aerator and I guess a compact fluorescent light bulb, but there are different configurations of boxes, right? But then they would have these exercises to go home and actually install them.
That's correct. So it was designed to be as turnkey as possible for teachers and as hands-on for students as possible. So this engaged the kids in their own learning, but then they obviously became very compelling ambassadors when they took this home and mom and dad came home to see their kid in the standing in the shower with a wrench and a new shower head. So they got a little bit more involved than they might have otherwise.
You mentioned the energy savings. I mean, but on the water side, and the shower heads were really fantastic. I remember the first water efficient shower heads, and I remember the company Niagara, and maybe they've got more advanced products now, but the early Niagara water efficient shower head was something that we all envisioned was used on a submarine and basically squirted water through some very tiny pinholes and almost hurt your skin when it was applied. And then the ETL, I think it was the Energy Technology Laboratories was the name of Ray Engel's company. And those would suck, as I understand it, here's a very simplistic view, but suck air into that process. So you're not getting pelted with, you know, needle-like water. You're getting air and water mixed together for a more fulfilling shower. And what was the flow rate on those shower heads versus a typical one?
Well, if memory serves, because now it's been 25, 30 years almost, 2.5 gallons per minute, and then down to 2.25, I believe. But at the time, most shower heads were in the 3 to 5 gallons per minute range. And as you correctly point out, the technology at the time wasn't that, you know, consumer friendly. It was kind of like the flickering CFLs that first came out or had really bad startup or poor lighting color. And so, yeah, as you said, they'd either be needles or dribbles or mist. In fact, there was actually a Seinfeld episode where Kramer was talking about, you know, he was actually buying a black market shower head because he couldn't get the shampoo out of his hair and it was causing him considerable consternation. And, you know, the guy that was selling him, it was he kind of backed up a van into an alley and sold him the some fantastic X1000 shower head. And he says, "Oh no, you don't want that. That's for the circus, for elephants." And he says, "Oh no, I want that." You know, so you don't want pressure. So yeah, we've come a long way.
Well, and I was just to bring it up to the current day or the present day, Terry and I were just up at Esalen up at Big Sur for a retreat last weekend, which is beautiful. And in our hotel room at the Institute, there was an ETL shower head. And she said, "I like the shower head. It's getting the shampoo out of my hair." And I said, "Oh, that's an ETL." She goes, "What? You know about that shower head?" So I came home and just yesterday, I had a few of the ETL shower heads in my shop. And I just took the one in our bathroom and I put in one of these ETL shower heads. And she's very happy about that. I scored some big points. So by the way, is that company still in business, ETL?
Yes. Well, ironically, you mentioned Niagara. Niagara acquired ETL. So the designs are now continuing to evolve and become a little bit more consistent. And there's all kinds of versions of this, which incorporate handhelds and whatever. But it's been a number of years since I've been with a firm. So I moved on and really moved into the utility world more actively when I joined the Holy Cross Energy Board.
Yeah, let's shift into that because that's the meat of the matter here. And first off, what motivated you to run? I mean, it's an elected position. What motivated you to run to be on the board of directors of Holy Cross Energy?
Well, it really came out of my experience with ETL and Resource Action Programs, Ted. What I had been inspired by is the innovation, the creativity, the passion of the various utilities and the individuals I've been working with. And I was right in the midst of some of the most creative and forward-looking program designs. And I thought, man, we should be able to do that here because an electric cooperative is one of the most democratic forms of a utility. It's in structure and in theory, very responsive and adaptive. So I wanted to be able to experience that and be able to stay connected to this rapidly transforming industry, but yet bring it home to this, somewhat sleepy little valley that we call home.
And how was it campaigning? I wouldn't know where to start. Was that a difficult thing to do or how did you win?
It's a matter of just kind of having a simple, easy to understand platform, clean energy, transparency, and being responsive to member interests, and then getting the word out and just it's a lot of get out the vote type of activities. So it's surprising that even in a really engaged area, the turnouts are very light. And so you get some momentum going and it's, I don't want to kind of gloss over it, but it was great. Letters to the editor, email chains. This was before social media was really a thing, but Facebook was, sort of a shadow of what it is today and utilize that.
Well, congratulations. And what would you say in those early years in particular, what were the biggest challenges? You wanted to, as I read in some of your materials, you know, you wanted to make this a really consumer centric, you know, utility. Kind of trying to shift the model, I guess, from, you know, sort of centralized power plants and, you know, a utility that is just delivering a commodity to a utility that's focused on what consumers really need and want.
Well, that's right. That was one of the real drivers for me, because I saw the evolution of the broader utility industry from being just sort of a commodity sales model, where you're just out there, you're like a kilowatt hour store and selling as many kilowatt hours as possible. And that first moved into perhaps a more competitive mindset. You're still a monopoly as an investor owned, but many utilities were shifting into this consumer centric mindset. And so that's where you're really looking at electricity and energy services, related services, from the perspective of your consumers. And so that's the big shift that was going on as I started in 2010. And that's, you know, to get that rolling requires some patience, some politics, and then some movement as far as prices and barriers to the evolution of both different program opportunities and none bigger than affecting how our power supply is configured and what our sources of electricity are. And then as a director, our primary responsibility is a fiduciary one. So we can't just go 100% clean energy overnight without, you know, raising our rates through the roof and upsetting our member owners and getting kicked off the board. So there's a real balancing act that's required to really affect progress.
And one of your biggest moves, I guess, as a board was to bring in Brian Hannigan as your general manager, right?
Absolutely. You know, one of the biggest responsibilities right after ensuring the financial health of the organization is to set strategic priorities and hire and oversee this president and CEO, the leader of the staff. And so when we brought Brian on board, this was reflective of our priorities and also with a great deal of enthusiasm and anticipation of the perspective that he could bring, because he had been such a diverse background between the White House and Congress and research labs and those types of positions, that coming in, he'd been working at everything around an electric utility, except at an electric utility. But he brought the vision and that outside perspective to us, to Holy Cross, to the benefit of our membership, and really to the benefit of the industry as a whole. Yeah, so we're tremendously excited about that.
Terribly impressed by what you all have done as a board and what he's done as a GM, and Chris Bilby and staff there that are just doing amazing works. And I love this this phrase that I also got from some of your materials, just that Holy Cross has been involved with the aggressive pursuit of economical clean energy, the aggressive pursuit. And this kind of relates back to some of my work here in Glendale that you and I have talked about. You know, we're certainly in a pursuit of economical clean energy, but I think Holy Cross is up the game and is in the aggressive pursuit. What would you say are some of Holy Cross's greatest accomplishments, you know, during your tenure?
Well, I think that we, you know, early on, one of the things that we accomplished was to broaden what at the time was a kind of like a public benefits charge. In other words, a surcharge on every kilowatt hour sold, which was, we call our We Care program. And this was a 2% fund. It was an adder that was placed before I came on board. And this was inspired by Randy Udall. He had a lot of influence there. It was used primarily for the acquisition of increasing in the early renewable energy power sources. When I came on board, we expanded that to carve out half of that to be used for energy efficiency. So that was a big milestone. Another milestone that I like to point towards that connects to this consumer-centric evolution is the evolution of our communications program, which went from, you know, keep the lights on, the rates low, and your mouth shut, to something that was a lot more interactive. And so not only did we start developing more energy service and consumer programs and talking about them, but we're also what now in the third stage of that, where we're really seeking more input and a real interactive relationship with our membership. And then, of course, the crown jewel, I believe, in my opinion, and I think for our membership and our board and our staff, is now our 100 by 30 program, which aims to be 100% renewable energy by 2030. And this was released in 2020, again, leading the pack industry-wide and certainly among co-ops nationally to have that type of a goal. Beyond that, we're working towards increased resilience. As you know, we've had a lot of wildfires here. Some of those came perilously close to having significant impact on our ability to provide electric service. And then also equity is kind of the other personal goal of mine, which we're working on. It's not a milestone or achievement yet, but that's kind of where we're heading.
Yeah. Well, it's congratulations on all those, your role in all of those. And when you mentioned the crown jewel, and then you mentioned the target, the 100 by 30 program, I thought you were going to talk about Holy Cross's brand new 5-megawatt photovoltaic installation, really at the entrance to Aspen, sort of in a spot that I know a little bit of the history of it being a sanitation spreading field, but you just can't imagine that you would have a ground mount in Aspen, given the real estate values. So that's a pretty cool accomplishment too, and a really visible statement for all of the people in the valley and all of the visitors in the valley.
Right. Well, you know, we've got a number of components, building blocks, if you will, that are just kind of building the stairway to achieve this. That 5-megawatt Pitkin solar project is a great one. It's somewhat visible. It's not too visible. We don't want to say that to the NIMBYs that put up the resistance to that. We've got a number of other great individual projects. You'd mentioned Chris Bilby, and he works closely with Brian in some of these real creative and dynamic projects. Basalt Vista is another one, which is a net zero affordable housing project that's located next to a school that houses teachers and county workers. That's a wonderful example of affordable housing that also provides a sort of a real-time workshop for Chris and the engineers. We've got some electrified school buses. In the pipeline, we've got a number of other sort of resilience efforts as well as some real innovative wildfire mitigation efforts that's increasingly important here. It spans the spectrum. And, you know, our staff just is so engineering oriented and future oriented to build a more resilient and interactive grid that's really necessary, not only for the stability of our service and the reliability of our service, but also to enable this fully renewable energy future. It's going to rely on some element of a distributed generation, distributed energy resource model to get all the way to 100.
Yeah, well put. Now, you mentioned Randy Udall. I worked with Randy at Rocky Mountain Institute. I guess Alice Laird and then Randy were instrumental in forming CORE, the Community Office for Resource Efficiency, a nonprofit serving originally the Aspen and Pitkin County, and I guess it has expanded to the Roaring Fork Valley. You, I guess Holy Cross has a seat on the board, and you've been filling that seat for 5 or 6 years. Let's talk a little bit about CORE and I know you feel strongly about that organization.
Yes, that's right, Ted. It's a great organization. It's 28 years old now, founded by Randy Udall. One of its real early achievements that propelled it forward was the Renewable Energy Mitigation Program called REMP, whereby these monster homes that get built that have a high energy footprint either have to provide on-site renewables to offset their impacts or pay into a fund. And so that fund has been very significant, and it's been sort of the legacy funding source for this office that then turned around and funded projects through grants, rebates, and demonstration projects to effectively deliver a higher greenhouse gas impact, reduction impact, than would have been achieved just by a net zero on site project.
Right. And then you've gone through lots of changes at CORE recently. You're bringing in a new executive director. I know you've been very instrumental with sort of re-envisioning how this 28-year-old now, you know, takes it to the next level and has a broader value in climate action in the whole valley.
Yeah, that's right. We're really excited about the transition we're in the middle of right now, where in my view, we're shifting from an energy focus to a climate focus. And that just really aligns well with the move at the utility level. I mean, the city of Aspen's already 100% renewable. Holy Cross is well on its way. And so as those utilities, which are such a low-hanging target for climate reduction and carbon reduction, as they clean up the electric supply, then it sort of shifts the approach to climate action. And that's really where I'm excited to see CORE gain a lot more traction. And the way I look at it, Ted, is there in our valley, there's been a lot of movement towards climate action plans and pronouncements and commitments. So the political will's there. But then the question remains, how are you going to actually get there? And how are you going to do that responsibly, which is, you know, goes back to that fiduciary responsibility that I, you know, have experience with at Holy Cross. So I'm really excited about the dynamic future that I see awaiting CORE to affect our region, which is three counties, and then potentially also showing how climate gets done at the ground level.
Yeah, good stuff. Dave, you're one of the most positive people that I've ever met. You smile, your smile is contagious, and I think that's just a terrific trait. And how do you, I know you've got one of the greatest gals as Stephanie, your wife, in the world, but how do you stay so positive and keep a balance between raising a family and working and being a board member and volunteering here and there? How do you do it all?
Well, I think it's a matter of perspective. And so being able to just go outside, appreciate where I live, maybe get a little exercise or activity, that just is very grounding for me. And, you know, I do really appreciate the blessing that it is to be able to live in a mountain area. I've kind of been a remote worker for nearly 40 years by now. So I was way ahead of the curve. I remember when fax machines came out, and I going back even further, I remember my dad saying, no, don't look at a career in forestry, you know, get a job that you like, that pays you enough money so you can go to the mountains on the weekends. Well, fortunately, the world's changed dramatically since that time, probably 50 years ago. And so I really do appreciate where I live. I get out there on skis, on a mountain bike, on a raft when I can, but just looking out the window, pausing for a moment when I'm, you know, out on the lawn, looking at the sky or whatever. And that's probably the biggest lever I can pull.
Well, thanks again, Dave. It's been great to share a little bit of time with you and get some insights on certainly on the operations of Holy Cross Energy and the philosophy behind its current structure. So that's it, folks. Thanks again for joining this episode of Flanagan's Net Positive Podcast. We'll see you next time.